Progression of the Assyrian Empire, which was then taken over by the Babylonian Empire, which was then in turn taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire. And some of these are difficult, some of them are hard. You know, the Babylonians, a hard one, but then the Medo-Persian guys were able to, just in one night, transfer pretty much all of world dominion from the Babylonians to the Medo-Persians. And as you might expect, this empire too was destined to fall, since, you know, the Medo-Persian Empire is not the major world. It's not the superpower in the world today. Obviously, they would fall. Who they're going to fall to, just to kind of give you a heads up at what we're looking at tonight, is the Greeks, the Greek Empire, or more literally and accurately, the Grecian Empire. That leads us to a lot of, you know, really poor jokes about guys who are self-conscious about their gray hair. It's one of the great things about many of us men is long before our hair turns gray, it all falls out, so you wouldn't know anyway. And the Greeks, we're at about the 500s B.C. In this study. And about 510 B.C., the Greeks entered the classical period. And you're probably familiar with this, maybe if you had art history, or maybe you're an art major and wondering what you're going to do with this. All I can tell you is, I don't know what you're going to do with the degree, but as far as the classical period, at least you're educated about that. This was a time when the Greek poets, literature, art, some really amazing and physically accurate human sculpture. You know, there's that famous statue of Zeus, you know, he's like, kind of thing, you know, that kind of stuff. That's going to translate well on the tape, I bet. The classical period, the literature, the art, the sculpture, poetry, some really amazing stuff taking place in the Greek culture. Unfortunately for them, during this exact same time period that this was happening, the Persian Wars began. And that is the Medo-Persian Empire desiring to take over even more of the world and making incursions into Greece. Now, the issue with that is it seemed like it was kind of a gimme, because Greece was not one big nation. It was a lot of what are called city-states. And basically a city-state is you get a strong, you know, metropolitan kind of strong city somewhere in the middle, and they end up taking over, some territory, and they say, we're a city-state. You know, and usually the city-state is named after the city. But there's a lot of them. It's kind of, if you picture the United States as states but not united. Okay, so there's the capital city, and then there's the state, but then, and they're all in one area, but they're not united together in a federal republic kind of thing. So a lot of the city states that bordered the Medo-Persian Empire very quickly fell. The Medo-Persians were able to come in and attack them, kind of pick them off one by one. And for a while, it looked like all of Greece would eventually succumb to this powerful, you know, Persian enemy. In the year 490, so we've advanced, you know, about 20 years from the beginning of the classical period. In the year 490, the Persians set their sights on Athens. And Athens, one of the most powerful city-states, yet the Persians had a pretty powerful navy, and so they figured, you know, we can do this. We can, and sent an invasion force of 25,000 men. Athens' army, you know, at best they could raise probably 10,000 men. So the Persians got to shore and set up camp, basically camped out on the plains of Marathon. And when this was heard by the Athenians, the people of Athens, like, you know, were getting nervous and scared, and so they got their local FedEx guy, and of course they didn't have trucks back then, so the FedEx guys had to run. Got the local professional runner to run to Sparta, another city state, the Spartans. And that's 140 miles away to ask for help. So this guy takes off and gets there to Sparta. If you can imagine having that job, you know, if you're a UPS guy or delivery man, I feel bad for you because you're on your feet all day. Well, if you're a professional runner and you're running 140 miles to, you know, you're getting there, you're like, Persians, Athens, we need help. And the Spartans said, well, we're in the middle of this whole religious festival thing. Sorry. And, when can you help? Well, you know, as soon as the full moon happens, then our religious festival's over and then we can come help. Well, by then that's too late. So the runner then has to run back and say, no help from the Spartans. Now, when this runner, his name is really hard to pronounce, and I'm probably butchering it for those of you in the know, but Phidippides, Phidippides, Phidippides. Phidippides needs to eat his Wheaties because he's now run 280 miles. He gets back to Athens. Well, the Athenians say, well, we have no choice but to go to war. They get their 10,000 guys, including Phidippides, who has just run 280 miles, and they march the 25-point-something miles to the plain of Marathon and engage in battle. And believe it or not, 10,000 versus, you know, you're outnumbered more than 2-1. The Athenians were able to defeat the Persians, soundly defeat the Persians. As a matter of fact, the Athenians lost less than 200 guys in this battle, and the Persians lost over 6,000. So it was pretty good. Well, with this victory, you know, and the rest of the 20 or 19,000 Persians jump back into the boats. And what's interesting is a lot of the Athenians jumped into the water pursuing these guys that are swimming back to their boats. And I think there were 6 or 7 ships of the Persians that they actually captured. The rest of the Persian fleet gets away, and the Athenians realize they're gonna round the coast here, and they're gonna go attack Athens, and here's all our whole army here. We gotta warn them. Is there a runner around here? Phidippides barely lift his arm. Yeah, I'm a runner. I'm a FedEx guy, and so he does, and so he runs almost 26 miles from the plain of Marathon. Are you getting the story here? From the plain of Marathon to Athens to say, hey, we won, but there's a chance of a sneak attack here. He gets the news of the victory out. He gets the warning after having run 140 miles, then another 140 miles, then marching 26 miles, and then running 26 miles, delivers the news, falls over dead. So in honor of him, we've completely forgotten his name, and we call the long-distance race the marathon. So, but in the deal there, it really, the Battle of Marathon was a definitive point in world history. It caused these Greek city-states to realize, united we stand, divided we fall, kind of thing. And so they ended up, what they ended up doing was trying to unite together under some common rulers or some common alliances. Unfortunately, they didn't get the clue that they all needed to be allied together. And so basically what ended up happening was they kind of chose Republican or Democrat is basically what they did. And they ended up as two groups. Most of these city-states were either allied with the Athenians or with the Spartans. But the Athenians and the Spartans didn't want anything to do with one another. They were just so radically separated and so radically different that, if they could have understood that within the grasp of their hands, they had this huge, possibly world-dominating power in their hands, and yet they couldn't get along because they were divided over ideological differences of politics and people and the person's relation to the state, you know, to their nation. And so, unfortunately, the Athenians and the Spartans, although they were able to push back the Persians, just for decades went at one another militarily and really caused a lot of damage. You see, the Athenians had a really powerful navy, but the Spartans had a really powerful army. And what ended up happening was for decades, for I think it was about 30, 35 years, that they went back and forth. And ultimately, it resulted in the destruction of Athens' navy. And that's in 405 BC, and then the next year, Athens totally surrendered to the Spartans. And you'd think, okay, now the Spartans are going to be this world power. Well, they were so weak from decades of war that they had almost wiped out the Athenians, and they'd almost wiped themselves out. It was kind of this mutual assurance of destruction kind of thing. So they've made themselves really, really weak. When united, they could have been, you know, a really formidable force. Now, during all this time, there's a lot of changes taking place. Some famous guys in Greek culture that you're probably familiar with, guys like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. You know, these guys, philosophers coming up with whole new ways of looking at life and the world and science and people and the soul and things. And some of their ideas, you know, pretty amazing, and others just kind of out to lunch. And if you read these things, you realize that it was guys like this that formed what we call Western thought. Our whole approach to government today, and our whole approach to life, and the idea of the city's relationship to the state and the state's relationship to the nation, and all these things go back to Greek culture. And you really cannot overemphasize the effect that the Greeks, and specifically these guys, had on the world as to how the world looks at politics and looks at people. So it's interesting, as you study this Greek thing, you say the art and the poetry and the literature and stuff was just amazing, and the philosophy and the thought and the politics and things, you know, just really advanced. And yet they're making the same dumb mistakes that man has made throughout, you know, the ages of let's blow one another up, you know, let's destroy one another in wars and make ourselves really weak. Well, not all of them had made themselves weak. There was one city-state that was not... It was one city-state that was not allied with either the Athenians or the Spartans. In fact, it was a kingdom. It was the only one of them that had a king ruling over them, and that's Macedonia. That's up in, if you're looking at a map of the Greek mainland, you're looking at the northeast. And they were kind of the buffer between all these city-states and the barbarians, basically all these groups up in Europe that were looked at as barbarians, and they were kind of a buffer zone. Well, the king of Macedonia, his name was Philip, in about the 350s BC. So we've advanced about 150 years from where we started. About the 350s BC, their king, Philip II, really ambitious, and he manages to make peace with the barbarians in the north. And then he looks to the south and says, all these city-states, after decades of fighting, they're all pretty weak. So systematically, one by one, started attacking them and taking them over. And ultimately is able to, by 338 BC, it conquers them all and forces them into an alliance, forces them into what he called the Federal League of Corinth. So you could kind of think of it as the United States of Greece, almost. The Federal League of Corinth, it unites all these city-states together, and now they've got, you know, hey, we've got some unity. It was kind of shaky unity, you know, and nobody really likes being told, look, you're going to be part of our country whether you like it or not. But it was unity, and they realized, hey, you know, we've got some stability here. And so a year after that, in 337 BC, Philip announces to the League of Corinth, this United States of Greece, if you want to call it that, announces, we're going after the Persians. You know, 100, however many years ago, somewhere between 100 and 200 years ago, they attacked us. They did all this stuff. Well, we're gonna deal out some retribution. Well, no, I don't know of any historian that actually believes what Philip said was actually his motivation. His motivation was probably nothing's going to firm up our alliance better than having a common enemy. You know, if we all go to war together, then we won't have these little infighting kind of things. And plus, hey, free stuff. Anytime you go to war with somebody and you win, it's free stuff, you know. So the timing seemed to be really good because they had this alliance, And at the same time, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire had died and his son had just taken over that very year. And that was always really shaky. When there's a new king on the throne, he's got to consolidate power and he's got to build some respect. And so it's kind of a shaky time. And so he's saying, you know, Philip of Greece is saying, let's go after the Medo-Persian Empire. Well, unfortunately for Philip, he never got a chance to make these plans happen because he was assassinated. Some historians have blamed his son. There was some issues. There were some personality conflicts and things, and nobody was ever charged with the crime or anything. But Philip II's son did then end up sitting on the throne over this Greek confederation. He's the king of Macedonia, but he's like the head of this whole federal league of Corinth. The son's name, he was 21 years old. His name's Alexander. Now, Alexander was historically, he was the prince, for 3 years, he was tutored by Aristotle personally and is described as brilliant and ambitious and super intelligent and just everything you can imagine, you know, to for the perfect, you know, super guy to be. This is him. You'd think at the age of 21, you know, how good of a king could he be? Well, he was already a seasoned war veteran. You know, he'd been leading cavalry charges and things, even winning huge decisive battles at the age of 18. Just a real go-getter kind of guy. So Alexander becomes the king of Macedon and the head of this league of the Greek city-states. And in 334 BC, he decides to implement his father's plan of invading the Medo-Persian Empire. It was really ludicrous if you looked at it because he had a very small army. He had no navy. He had zero financial resources. And he's saying, let's go attack the superpower in the world. Yeah, okay. Well, he did it really intelligently. He did it by basically picking and choosing his battles, the ones he knew he was pretty much guaranteed to win. The deal with winning is you get men and you get resources, you get finances, and every one of these battles that he won, his power would increase, his wealth would increase, and then that empowered him to go after bigger and bigger things. As a matter of fact, as he moved this invasion force bit by bit into Asia Minor, he never lost a battle. As a matter of fact, his whole life, he never lost a battle. Do you know people like this? They really annoy me. You know, it's like everything they do just turns to gold. And each one of these successive victories bringing him more and more resources and never losing. So what's interesting about this guy, if you haven't caught on yet, is we know him in history as Alexander the Great. And the Bible has a ton of prophecy that speaks specifically of this guy, of Alexander the Great. As a matter of fact, some of this prophecy of this time period that we're looking at reads so accurately, so specifically, so plainly that when you read it, you kind of get suspicious and go, come on, they wrote this after the fact. I mean, it's talking about such incredibly specific stuff that you say, this had to have been written after the fact, but fortunately we know historically that the scriptures were in the hands of the Jews and the copies distributed and were all over the known world in the hands of the Jews long before these things happened. And so it's not like, you know, I imagine that maybe someday somebody's going to come out with, they're going to watch CNN for a year and type out everything that happened and then pretend that their book was published 2 years ago. You know, and say, oh, look, I'm 100% accurate on all my prophetic things. Daniel reads like that. If you know your world history and you read the book of Daniel, you say, wow, this is like written after the fact, but it's written before the fact. One of these interesting prophecies that speak of Alexander is the destruction of the city of Tyre. Tyre is up the. It's if you know where the Mediterranean is, where Israel is, you just go north of Israel, and the city of Tyre was up there on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea, like right on the shore. And they're just across the border from the Israeli territory of the tribe of Asher. That's way up north in Israel. And they were allies of Israel for a long time. During the reigns of King David and King Solomon, they helped them out, and they had some, you know, mutual alliance stuff going on. But unfortunately, they ended up turning against Israel, even getting to the point where they were selling Jews as slaves. And this incurs the wrath of God. You know, God says all through the scriptures, you mess with my people and I'm going to mess with you. And that's never good when God messes with you. So the judgment that is being spoken against Tyre is in a number of places, but one of the fascinating ones is in Ezekiel chapter 26. And in Ezekiel 26, God promises that Tyre's towers are going to be broken down, that her debris, meaning the debris of the city, is going to be scraped and leaving just bare rock. I mean, God is getting so extreme. He's not saying all your people are going to be killed. You know, your city's going to be burned with fire. He actually says it's going to be scraped down to the bare rock. And that's hard to come up with a city, you know, in history that would have happened to. But God got real specific about that. He prophesied specifically about Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire, and said that Nebuchadnezzar is going to put the city to siege, but also that the city would become spoil for all the nations. And all these nations, Ezekiel 26:12, for example, they would throw your stones and your timbers and your debris into the water. So you get this idea of the city being scraped down to bare rock, everything being thrown in the water. And in verse 5, you know, it talks about, she will be a place for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea. So, and that doesn't even make any sense language-wise until you learn the history of what happened to this. After God prophesied this, Nebuchadnezzar did in fact put the city to siege. It was after his destruction of Jerusalem. After the destruction of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar headed north and attacked the city of Tyre by putting it to siege. And if you're not familiar with the process of putting a city to siege, you camp around it. You don't let anybody in or out, and eventually you starve them out. And it was hard to put Tyre to siege because it's right on the coast. So, you know, you can kind of make a half moon around a half circle, but you can't really do anything. Nebuchadnezzar didn't have boats and stuff, but, you know, when he was, you know, it wasn't like he was carrying them from Jerusalem. Oh, we got all these boats. So there's no way to really deal with the sea side of things, but he's put the city to siege on the land side of things. And it would prove to be pretty difficult. The siege lasted 13 years. And that's a long time to be camping anywhere. I tell you, you know, a week of camping is too much for me. Actually, when it comes to camping, a day and a half of camping is too much for me. But 13 years. And what's interesting is the way that ancient armies were paid, the soldiers in the army, the way they were paid was when they won and they got all the spoils of the battle. Well, when you're camping out waiting for a victory for 13 years, people get a little upset. And it was very difficult. Nebuchadnezzar did actually, after 13 years, manage to take over Tyre. But the issue was, the problem was, in this 13 years, everybody in Tyre had moved away. They didn't move far. They moved about a half mile away, but they moved a half mile offshore. You see, there's this little island a half mile offshore of Tyre. And during the siege, the Tyrians, I forget what they're called, but the inhabitants of Tyre, maybe we'll just call them Tyres, you know, the Michelins, the Goodyears, you know, all these. There's a really fat white guy they call the Michelin Man, you know. They all get into boats and take everything of value and take supplies and take food and everything that they need, and they all move. So the Michelin Man didn't need a boat, obviously. He just floated across. But this channel of water, this half mile of water, is 20 feet deep, and the island has 150-foot high walls, these cliffs on one side, and they pretty much thought they were invincible. So by the time Nebuchadnezzar got in there to Tyre, it was empty, you know, and he took it over and went, everything's gone. And here's his guys have been waiting for 13 years to get paid, and they look around, and there's like, there's nothing here. You know, I found a Kleenex. You know, I mean, that's pretty much what you're looking at. So they weren't happy at all. The entire population of Tyre had been relocated, and they were safe on this island for 250 years. And they got pretty prideful. They thought, man, nobody can mess with us and stuff. And Nebuchadnezzar obviously went away. The city was destroyed, but it didn't matter to them because they liked their new location a lot better. It was certainly a lot safer. Well, then comes the reign of Alexander the Great. And Alexander's taken over everything. And Alexander, you know, he wasn't dumb. He knew that it's better to take something over by diplomacy, you know, get a good surrender than, you know, to kill everybody and lose some of your own guys. So he sends messengers to Tyre, to this island off the coast of Tyre, sends these messengers while he's marching, basically, if you think of it as down, he's going south towards Egypt, and he's gonna mess with Egypt big time, you know, and so he doesn't really want to stop and deal with Tyre. He'd much rather just have him surrender. So he sends messengers there and offers them a treaty of peace. But the people of Tyre, they think they're invincible. You know, they've gone 2.5 centuries now without ever being attacked. There's no problem. You know, they're fat, dumb, and happy sitting on their island, and so they're all full of themselves. And they kill the messengers and throw them over the cliff into the sea. Well, Alexander hears this and he makes a U-turn, you know, because he's been heading south towards Egypt. He makes a U-turn and he's like, we're messing with you and we're messing with you bad now. So they had not, you know, done a good thing, but Alexander and his whole huge, you know, Grecian army, all of them looking very young and dark haired, get to where Tyre was. And, you know, it's all broken down. They look a half mile offshore, and there's all the people going, hello. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You can't attack it by sea because of these 150-foot high walls. You can't attack it from land because it's too far. You know, you can't, you might be able to throw a pigskin over that mountain range over there, but you can't. Anybody get that? But only two. But you can't shoot effective arrows, you know, from your archers a half mile over into the island and hope to hit anything. And certainly your catapults aren't going to go that far. What are you going to do? The land's too far away, and see, you can't do anything. Well, Alexander's a bright guy, and he looks around at his mess, and he looks at this island a half mile offshore and says, why don't we just bring the land closer to them? And has his guys, over the course of 7 months, this was in 332 BC, January to July. Over the course of 7 months, they take all the stuff, all the rubble from this former city of Tyre, and start a building project. They're building a land bridge. They're taking all of the stones and timber and everything and throwing it into the sea. This 20-foot deep channel of water that's a half mile long, they start throwing the stuff in there, and they are able to make a bridge that is, I think I wrote this down. Well, obviously it's 20 feet high at least, because you've got to be able to walk across the water. It's 200 feet wide, and slowly but surely over the course of 7 months, bring it all the way to the island. And, you know, you gotta wonder what the people of Tyre were thinking. You know, they're looking behind them going, is there another island? Is there somewhere we can go? And it was brutal. It was brutal. And Alexander really took it out on them. 7,000 of the people of Tyre died defending that island. 2,000 of them were crucified on the beach. Big long line all the way down the beach. 2,000 of them being crucified. The other 30,000 of them, because remember, there's 37,000 people in this island, and the rest of the 30,000 of them sold into slavery, which obviously helped Alexander financially and getting his revenge. You know, next time I offer you a treaty of peace, maybe you think about it instead of sending my guys into the water. Now, as the end of the siege of Tyre is happening, he's coming to the end of it. Josephus is a Jewish historian, and he has some just amazing, amazing stuff to say about this whole time period. And when you read Josephus, it's fascinating because a lot of the accounts that he has are parallel with biblical accounts. That this is a guy who was either eyewitness to, or he's writing about this stuff that just happened a couple hundred years ago, and so Josephus is a fascinating read if you can, if you're not bored by history. If you're bored by history, don't buy the book, you know. But in his book Antiquities of the Jews, he writes that as Alexander's approaching the end of the siege of Tyre, he sends a letter. You know, he's sending a letter to another city, and you know, you gotta wonder why anybody, if they got a letter from Alexander, would not say, okay, we'll do whatever you say. But he's 7 months off schedule. And he's still got to head down south to Egypt to conquer them. So he sends letters in advance to Jerusalem. And looking for the guy in charge in Jerusalem, well, that was the high priest. And in that time, the high priest was Yadua, the high priest, and he gets this letter from Alexander requesting supplies and some support. Well, the Yadua, the high priest, tells the messengers that bring the letter. Now, he didn't kill them and throw them over the wall. That was good. But he says, no, I'm not going to do it. So the messengers come back to Alexander and said, hey, that high priest down in Jerusalem said no. Well, now Alexander's mad again. Probably not as mad as he was at the people of Tyre, but he's still mad. And so he's enraged. He vows that as soon as Tyre is conquered, then he's going to head down to Jerusalem and make an example of this high priest, of Yadua. He's going to make an example of him and basically going to string him up and make him an example to anybody that would dare to oppose Alexander the Great. Well, Alexander and his army start marching towards Jerusalem. They're headed south from Tyre down through Israel to Jerusalem. And obviously the high priest gets a little nervous. Josephus said he was terrified because he's just told Alexander the Great to, you know, shove off, you know, and he's not helping you. And so he calls the people of Jerusalem together for prayer and for fasting to cry out to God. And Josephus writes that God gave Yadua a dream. And in this dream, he was told to decorate the city, that he's to open the gates and welcome Alexander, that the high priest and all the priests are to dress in their you know, Sunday best, their military blue, their dress blues, whatever you call them, their uniforms, and all the people of the city are supposed to dress in white. And so it'd be kind of a surreal experience, you know, that Alexander would show up knowing that that everybody's going to be terrified of him. And yet they're like having this big, everybody's in white, come on in kind of greeting sort of thing. Well, Alexander shows up, sees this big procession, and Josephus writes that he approaches the high priest. You expect the high priest to die. Well, he salutes him. And when he gets back to his guys, when Alexander gets back to his guys, because Alexander had gone into the city by himself, and when he goes back to his guys, all his allies, saying, what was up with that? I thought you were going to string him up. I thought you were going to make an example of him. Well, Josephus writes that Alexander's reply was this: I didn't adore him, but that God who hath honored him with his high priesthood, for I saw this very person in a dream. So Josephus is saying that the high priest had a dream, do it this way, and Alexander is saying, you know, I had a dream too. I saw this guy in a dream. In this very habit, you know, in this, I saw this guy, not just his face, but everything that is similar the way it was. He said, I had this dream when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians, whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering the vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians. Basically, what Alexander's saying is, I saw this guy in a dream, and it was a long time ago. I've just kind of now remembered it, never saw anybody else in this outfit. Now I see this guy, and I realize that his God has directed that I'm gonna beat the Persians, that I'm gonna defeat the Medo-Persian Empire, and that it was by God's direction. And when word of this gets around, the priests to, and again, Josephus writes all this. And if you do have Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, this is in Antiquities 11:8-5, I think it is, 11:8-5, which is book 11, chapter 8, paragraph 5. But as you read this, then the priests show Alexander the book of Daniel, which they had. And they show him the book of Daniel and read all this stuff to him, and he's amazed. Josephus says, and when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, Alexander supposed that himself was the person intended. So he sees this prophecy and goes, that's talking about me. That, and so it was just more confirmation for him. So it's really fascinating when you consider that Alexander had headed towards Jerusalem with the intention of making an example of them, or at very least the high priest, and then to go, you know, to take over all the land of Israel and then take over all the land of Egypt. It's interesting that Alexander didn't do that. Instead, being, as near as we can tell from the historian Josephus, directed by God and not taking over all this, not conquering them. He did continue on down to Egypt, but then when he went back, he took the same route back north through Jerusalem again, through Israel again, and again didn't attack them. And it seems that in the context of Zechariah's prophecy in Zechariah 9, that that it seems to be the fulfillment of that when he says, but I will camp around my, God says, I will camp around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns. So as you study through Zechariah 9, you can look into that at another time. But so with this divine mandate, you know, realizing that God's called me to conquer the Medo-Persian Empire, Alexander, within 2 years, has completely taken over the entire Medo-Persian Empire. And so, you know, where do you go when you've taken over the world empire? Where do you go? Well, you go to the outskirts of civilization. You take over everything that you can. And so that's what Alexander did. He continued on conquering all of the known world with such amazing speed that when you read the accounts, you say, how in the world did anybody humanly possibly do this in such a short period of time? And just such incredible speed of conquering literally all of the known civilized world. Now, this stuff was all, like Josephus had said, it was all prophesied in Daniel. And if you're a student of Daniel, this stuff sounds familiar to you. It's given in a number of different visions and different ways. One of them, in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, and I guess you can go there. We'll be in Daniel for a few minutes here. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream of a great statue. Maybe you've read this before and been confused by it, about the head of gold, and it goes on to the various descriptions all the way down to the 10 toes of iron mixed with clay. And he has this dream, and Daniel interprets the dream, and this statue has a belly and thighs of bronze, and Daniel says this is a third kingdom. And Daniel, as you're now a student of history and you realize, okay, we had the Babylonian Empire and then we had the Medo-Persian Empire and now we're at the Grecian Empire, and you look at the statue and the way Daniel describes it is just amazing, again, to think that this was given in advance. This third kingdom of bronze, which Nebuchadnezzar was told by Daniel would rule over all the earth. And in fact, that's what Alexander's kingdom ended up doing. Now, later, Belshazzar, the king, has a dream. Only he's got a dream not of a statue, but of beasts. These beasts that rise up, and this time, Alexander's kingdom is described as a winged leopard. So, you know, again, this describes complete speed. You know, the winged leopard that. I wonder if I wrote down what chapter that was. I guess I didn't. You'll have to check that out. But then Daniel has his own vision. He's not just interpreting the dreams, but by chapter 8, he has a vision when the four beasts was in Daniel 7, by the way. And then in Daniel chapter 8, there's a lengthy vision that appears to him subsequent to the one that had appeared to him previously. And he looks in this vision in chapter 8 and around verse 5. He says, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground." So again, it's talking about just incredible speed here. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. So this is a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple goat guy. It's a goat with one horn, you know, right here. It's very conspicuous. And what's this thing doing? Well, he comes up to the ram that had the two horns, and he had seen this ram earlier, with two horns, and he comes up to the ram with the two horns, which he had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him, meaning the goat hurled the ram, to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. So as you look at this, you realize, okay, the goat is the Grecian Empire. The one horn is Alexander the Great. The two-horned ram that was described earlier is the kingdom that was before them. Why two horns? Well, the Medes and the Persians together, they've been described as in the statue, it had two arms, and in this vision has two horns. The Medo-Persian Empire being utterly destroyed and decimated by this one-horned goat. And takes over the whole known world. Alexander's conquest of the world is complete. But unfortunately for Alexander, he's not. His conquest of the world was complete, but he's not. He's attained everything he ever wanted. And he found it completely dissatisfying. I think that's as just if I can interrupt our history lesson for a minute and remind you of the scene, if you remember the Gene Wilder movie with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Willy Wonka or whatever the movie was called, you know what I'm talking about. And at the end, when Charlie's inherited everything, sorry if I give this away, but he inherits the whole candy factory, okay? And the Willy Wonka and Charlie are in this glass elevator together, and Gene Wilder or Willy Wonka says, "Hey, careful, Charlie, now don't forget what happened to the boy who suddenly received everything he ever wanted." "No, you know, what happened?" He said, "He lived happily ever after." That is the biggest lie perpetrated upon the children of America of my generation. If you get everything you ever wanted, you'll live happily ever after. Well, guess what? It's a lie. It's a lie. You know, if you sat down and analyzed your goals, let's say you had a goal that you had, you know, you had said, if I want to get, you know, a 3.9 or 4.0 in high school, and then I want to go to college and major in this and then get a successful career and own a house. And, you know, these are my goals. And then you attain those things and you look around, and you go, that's pretty much everything I ever thought of doing. You know, I've hit that point in my life before where all the vision I had was fulfilled. It was done. And I became pretty despondent. I was pretty bummed because I got everything I'd ever planned to get, and it was completely unsatisfying. There was no sense of completion. There was just, well, now what do I do kind of thing. Alexander hit that point. He conquered, he returns to Babylon, which he had made the capital of his empire, as literally the king of the world. He was king of the world. And he's 32 years old. And he's totally not complete. Within a year, he was dead. He died at the age of 33, having conquered the whole world and being totally unsatisfied. Why in the world we strive when every example, you strive for money, talk to some rich people before that becomes your goal. Striving for a career, talk to the head honchos in your career field and see how satisfied they are. oh, but you're famous. You know, you're writing all the journals, or you're always on the news, or you're always... How satisfied are they? Probably less than you. Why don't we get that? What if the whole world... You know, Jesus said, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and yet lose his soul? I'd rather, you know, be a college dropout and work in, you know, fast food and have a complete soul than own the whole fast food corporation and be totally empty. It's just, it's craziness why we do that. Alexander died at the age of 33. Well, you can imagine if you died at the age of 33, you probably didn't have a retirement plan in place. You know, you realize somewhere when you hit about 40 and you kind of panic and you look around, you're going, oh man, my 401k has $300 in it. And I don't have a, you think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. And you start going, oh man, I better start planning for the future here. I've got, you know, 20 years till retirement. Well, when you're the king of the world at the age of 33, the last thing you're thinking about is succession. Is, okay, what happens when I get old and die, and let's put a plan into place. See, our government has set up to where, you know, if the president falls over dead, then, you know, the vice president does this, and if he falls over dead, and they've got this whole series of, you know, down to the janitor of the White House. If these 35,000 people die, then the janitor of the White House becomes the president. They've got this whole order of succession. Alexander had none of that in place. It was in his early 30s. Well, he dies and nobody knows what to do. So the generals of his armies and you know, where the generals kept their armies was in their sleeveys. And yeah, okay. The generals who had helped him along the way divided up the kingdom. They divided it up and said, you know, okay, you get this section, you get this section, you get this section. And that led to tons of fighting, obviously, because this whole kingdom had been split up. And all of these guys who had, their mentor, their buddy Alexander, had taken over the whole world. What's to prevent me from doing that too? And so it was bloody. It was disastrous. It was a mess. Ultimately, four of them, within, I think it was about 20 years. I think it was four of them. I don't know if I wrote that down, but I think it was about 20 years that they had just really, really, none of them had been able to conquer the others, or all of the others, I should say. But by the time 20 years passed, four of them stood out, these four guys, and they all declared themselves kings in the beginning of dynasties and things. They were the generals. One of them, I think, was a lieutenant, but had risen up. By 300 BC, now there's four empires. Greece is being ruled by Antigonus, and Greece and Macedonia. Asia Minor, a guy named Attalid is over Asia Minor. Then the two guys that we're probably going to focus on more is the guy who occupied the Middle East and Mesopotamia is a guy named Seleucus. And then Egypt is taken over by Ptolemy. You probably have heard of Seleucus and Ptolemy. This, again, if you look at the scripture and the prophecy that that Daniel gives, in this goat, it said in chapter 8, Daniel 8:8, if you're still there, the male goat, remember the Grecian Empire, you know, with the horn being Alexander, it says the goat, male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. So this is pretty specific as talking about this, you know, the one guy is broken and the four guys come out. And as you look at this, and again, if that's a little too out there for you, if that sounds a little bit like when I was talking this morning about Nostradamus and how you know, ethereal and you know, easy to interpret those things however you want to. Daniel gets really specific. By the time Daniel 11 rolls around, these things are interpreted very plainly. Daniel 11, chapter 3 says, a mighty king will arise. Daniel 11:3. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out towards the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor ascending, or nor according to his authority, which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. So however you want to interpret goats and rams and horns and things, maybe that's too out there for you. This is really specific, isn't it? That we see this interpretation is very clear, that he's talking about a king who is going to be, who is going to die, but then be replaced not by sons, but these others. And they're not going to imitate his kingdom, but there's going to be these four of them. It would be really difficult for us to trace tonight the history of all four of these empires and how they all worked out. For our purposes, I know we've promised history and future of the world, but really we kind of zero in on God's people as it relates to this. So the two of those empires, the Seleucid dynasty that Seleucus started, and the Ptolemaic dynasty that Ptolemy in Egypt. These guys, they're in the Middle East and in the north, and then you've got Ptolemy down in Egypt, and these guys became, well, obviously they were bitter rivals and enemies, but they kind of had a back and forth of competition of who was gonna take over the world. Unfortunately, the world, the piece of land that's between Egypt and the north part of the Middle East, between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, is Israel. And so they become like the battleground for a long time. You know, the Egyptian guys would move up into the north and fight the Seleucids, and then the Seleucid guys would come down into the south and fight the Ptolemies in from Egypt. And so they were like, it was kind of like living in the army, what do they call those, when they blow things up in these testing fields. It's kind of like living there. And so that proved to be pretty disastrous for the Israelites. If you read Daniel chapter 11, and again, we don't have time. We're almost out of time now. If you read Daniel 11, especially if you're familiar with the history of how the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemies in Egypt did the whole back and forth thing, then again, it's just fascinating. We do have a study on this, Daniel chapter 11, the study we did a number of years ago that's still on tape. It might even be on CD, and you can pick that up from the media ministry. Goes into all that detail, but the detail is just stunning of Daniel foretelling all this stuff in very specific accuracy. Ultimately, the conflicts between the Seleucids and the Ptolemy's dynasty lead to the death of Seleucus IV. And Seleucus IV, his younger brother, rises to power and ultimately does something to the Jews that resulted in a yearly observance we call Hanukkah. And we're going to save that for next week. Okay, it's a study unto itself. I think we can talk for an hour about this. If you're familiar with Antiochus Epiphanes, the foreshadowing of the Antichrist, one of the most evil men that's ever walked the face of the earth, and the abomination of desolation of the temple. Fascinating story, and the time of the Maccabees and their rebellion and their restoration of the temple. We'll talk about that next week, because I don't want to try and cover it in 2 minutes and really, you know, rip us off at a lot of the details of that. So let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, we are thankful again for the opportunity to be reminded of your sovereignty, of the accuracy of your word, Lord, of the emptiness of the promise that the world holds out to us when they say, you'll be satisfied, you'll be fulfilled if you just make this much money or get this much stuff or this level of notoriety or fame in the business world or in the entertainment world. Lord, we realize that we could conquer the whole world and our soul would still not be satisfied. That we could attain everything we ever wanted and discover that everything that we'd been striving for was a big, empty lie because it would not fulfill us. Lord, we are grateful for the accuracy of the prophecy that you've given to us and how encouraged we are to be reminded, even as we were this morning, that the fulfillment of prophecy in the past is our guarantee that the prophecies for the future will be fulfilled. And Lord, those of us that have been born again, who are your children, look forward to the future that's been prophesied and promised to us. And we pray that it would put a fire in us to cause those who are not yet your children to hear the gospel and to be presented with the choice of responding to it. And so we pray, Lord, that as we go out from this place and on into the week, whether we're heading to work or to school or into the community, Lord, that you would give us that fervor to share your word and its accuracy and its prophecy and the gospel that it promises to those who believe. And so we commit ourselves to you, Lord. We pray that you'd open up these opportunities to share the truth of your word and the promise of the future that you give to those who have faith in your Son, Jesus Christ. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.